The judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court.
Unless there is any more question, we have to find an argument in this case.
All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to give their attention.
Welcome to Divided Argument, an unscheduled, unpredictable Supreme Court podcast. I'm Dan Epps.
And I'm Will Pode.
So, Will, we have more to talk about from Wednesday's opinion release. The court gave us too much to do in just one episode. Didn't want to do like a 2 hour plus long episode. Thought we'd give you more digestible chunks.
Yeah, you know, Dan, you predicted this. You predicted they were going to jam us up at the end of the term with too many interesting opinions at once.
Yeah.
But they were not prepared for our willingness to just sit down and break it into a couple episodes if there's a lot to talk about.
Yeah. And the court has made a serious strategic mistake as well, because we should give people a little advance notice that you and I are both traveling on Friday for unrelated reasons. And that means we're not going to record right on Friday. We're going to be a little late giving you coverage of those Friday decisions, unfortunately. So you'll have to wait for some colder takes and get your hot takes elsewhere. But the court's error was in dumping some of the more interesting cases today. Because I was looking at the list of the kind of final, I think it's eight left, right? And, you know, there's some decently big ones there. But on the whole, you know, it's not eight blockbusters, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. They gave us some of the ones I was most interested in we now have. Especially this case, Collins versus Yellen. You follow this case, Dan?
I have followed this one a fair bit. It's really interesting. It's kind of an intersection of structural constitutional law and finance. It's got a little bit of administrative law in it. There's a lot here. There's a lot of moving pieces in this case. And so, you know, we're going to have to do our best to disentangle that for people. But yeah, this one is quite interesting. And that's a good place to start. And I would say of this case is probably the one on which the most money was resting.
Of not more than term. Not more than the Affordable Care Act case.
Yeah, I mean, although I guess maybe I'm approaching that from the perspective of, you know, assuming that it was never that likely they were going to strike down the entire thing. But yes, I guess theoretically, if they had struck down the entire Affordable Care Act, more money would have moved, would have had bigger economic impact. But this one had a lot of money riding on it, because here's what happened. So we have the financial crisis, the old one, not, you know, pre-pandemic. This was the 2008 financial crisis caused by subprime mortgages, all that stuff that I would imagine some of our listeners don't remember, right? Some of our listeners who were law students, I mean, this would have happened when they were like in, I don't know, middle school or something, right? But it was a big deal. Economy really was in really bad shape, and for quite a while. But things were like at the beginning when everything kind of collapsed and the stock market went down really rapidly. All of a sudden, things were bad. And Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are these two corporations that are kind of like sort of they're public-ish, but their shares are privately traded. They previously were kind of purely public, and then they were somewhat privatized, but they kind of serve this like public function of buying the underlying mortgages, most of the mortgages on houses that are sold in the United States. They were in real trouble, right? They were, you know, their soundness was very much in jeopardy as a result of all these mortgages not being paid, because there had been these incentives for banks to basically sell a bunch of mortgages to people that couldn't really afford to pay them. And so these were going to fall apart. And then so Congress did something kind of unusual here, right? They created this agency, FHFA, the Federal Housing Finance Agency, and they put in this single director who was, according to the statute, removable by the president only for cause. And then they went and did stuff. We can disagree about how to characterize what exactly happened here. Some people call this a nationalization of Fannie and Freddie. But basically, the government came in and kind of like acted as a conservator or conservator of Fannie and Freddie's assets, but basically put in place a regime under which the shareholders were not really going to get much, if anything, at all. Although this was all put in place in order to prevent the possibility that the companies would go out of business and the shareholders would get nothing.
Yeah. Okay.
Will, you look, you've got like a dazed look on your face. Is this too much money stuff?
I'm in it for the constitutional law, not the money, but
yeah,
but it's a lot of money. It's part of why it's important.
Yeah. Basically there was these kind of amendments that were put in place. There's kind of a more complicated backstory here that basically said, you know, Fannie and Freddie, you're going to like give us your money. It's called a capital sweep. And so long story short, the shareholders sort of got together and they've been suing to try to stop this and to get money back for what they claim is impermissible action by FIFA and like stealing their money. A lot of those claims have actually been sold to other companies, a lot of like hedge funds and banks and so forth are kind of like, it's kind of speculating about this case, waiting to see what was going to happen. And that's where all this money is riding.
Okay. So we just talked last episode about the takings clause. So we just start with, why isn't this just a takings problem? Like if the government's just kind of coming in and like, I don't know, unfairly confiscating a bunch of people's money in a way. I mean, should we think of it that way? Somehow that's just not on the table.
So as I understand it, that's something that had been one of the many claims that had been litigated in the lower courts. But that's not the one that for whatever reason makes it to the Supreme Court. So that's not what we're here to talk about.
Okay. So it's not a takings problem. Instead, it's a separation of powers problem that we have to worry about here, right?
Yeah. So as well, also in this case, there were some statutory challenges where the plaintiffs were saying, hey, what FIFA did here kind of exceeded its powers as the conservator, right? They were, you know, conservators typically are supposed to come in and they're kind of appointed to manage someone else's assets to kind of like make sure that they don't go bankrupt. But here they came in and basically just like, we're like, okay, now we're the government keeping everything for ourselves and shareholders take a hike. So that was also in the case that got to the court. There actually were kind of dueling cert petitions from either side. The government filed some cert petition and the shareholders filed a cert petition. So that's here too. The one we're most interested in though is the constitutional question.
Yeah, I gotta say my eyes glazed over for the part of the opinion about the statutory claims. So if there's anything there I need to know, you're going to have to tell me about it.
Not a ton. We can talk about it briefly, but it's a limitation on injunctive relief. So it's got kind of like a civ pro-y, fed courts-y angle.
Injunctions, I can understand.
Yeah.
Okay. So
yeah, what's the constitutional problem?
All right. So I got to say, I have a sense of deja vu here, right? So last term, we had a case called Saleh Law about a government official who was the director of the CFPB, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, who was a single person who could be removed by the president only for cause, created by a statute also at around the same time period. And the Supreme Court said, that's unconstitutional. If you have a single official, they have to be removable at will by the president. FIFA seems like the exact same thing, right? It's a single director.
Yeah, and just to back up one second, but yeah, we do know that having a multi-member agency under existing precedent, at least, you can have multi-member agency where the members are only removable for cause. That's Humphrey's executor, right?
Yes. As it happens, maybe this is just like a silly dodge in that the court happened to uphold a multi-member agency in Humphrey's executor. And now, you know, this is another one of those cases where there's a distinction without a difference. They say, this one is only a single person. Then Judge Kavanaugh, I think, came up with a kind of like not frivolous political theory argument about why it might be different for a single person who has sort of more potential for abuse of power than a multi-member body. But regardless, Saleh Law says, when you have a single member director, they have to be accountable to the president. They know
this is a thing we're going to circle back to in a minute, but like these kind of like political theory, you know, accountability arguments that flow through these conservative separation of powers cases drive me crazy. And they also drive one of the justices on the court crazy. So we'll get to that.
Not my favorite either, but
yeah.
Okay. But this is just deja vu. This is just the same thing we had last term, right?
Well, that's sort of the question, right? It does seem pretty similar. And there are, you know, there are a few places in the law that have these structures, single director, movable only for cause. I think it's not the default. Typically, you either have kind of an executive agency where there's like a secretary who's directly accountable to the president, removable at will, or you have these kind of multi-member agencies. But there are other ones, and this is another one, and does seem to have a lot of features in common. But we had some decent arguments here. So what happened was the federal government actually kind of agreed. They were like, yeah, unconstitutional restriction on removal. We agree with you on the merits of that. But, you know, obviously the federal government did not agree that that therefore meant the plaintiffs got billions of dollars.
Right. Well, and when you say the federal government, you mean the Solicitor General's office.
Yes. Sorry.
Which is part of the executive branch, reports to the president.
Yes.
So it may not be a shock that the president said, oh, yeah, I agree. I have a lot of power here. And this statute is unconstitutional.
Yeah. It's a situation where there can be kind of like a conflict of interest.
Right. So they actually
between the different parts of government.
So they actually had to bring in an amicus, a law professor, Aaron Nielsen, to brief and argue the case on behalf of the statute, essentially.
Yeah. And he was aided in his briefing by another law professor, Chris Walker of Ohio State. And they did a really good job, I think. They came up with a lot of arguments. And as to why this was distinguishable and to why there was no constitutional problem here. And I'm not going to cover all of those arguments. But like one that I thought was pretty interesting, the court obviously doesn't end up buying, was that the director of FIFA is basically not, you know, when he's serving as a conservator, he's not actually exercising executive power at all. It's like sort of more of like a private power. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Me too. I thought there might have been something to that. I don't know.
Yeah.
But the court says no.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then another argument they make that's in here is that for an important amount of the time here, the director was actually an acting director, not a confirmed director. And
so this is another way in which the case has like a few too many moving pieces, and it's a little hard to keep track of everything.
But I think it turns out there was a dispute of whether acting directors get the same kind of protection from removal, and the court concludes that they don't. So actually, for a bunch of the time here, it's kind of harmless error. Like for a bunch of the time, the director actually was removable just by the happenstance they happened to be an acting director. But the court says that doesn't matter.
And the director that actually engaged in the specific thing that they're worried about, like the Third Amendment to the purchase agreements that, you know, had all these bad consequences. That person was actually totally removable at will by the president.
Yeah. But then a later director was confirmed and they didn't undo it. And so maybe it's, you know, maybe it's still relevant, I guess, but it's a little weird. Okay. So put that aside too. So what does that leave us with? That leaves us with standing and severability, right?
Okay. Well, let's just get rid of the statutory.
Okay.
Statutory claim first. Fine. So they also, plaintiffs are also saying, look, director violated, you know, went beyond the statute and doing all this crazy stuff. And that's not what you're allowed to do when you're the conservator. And there's a statute that says, you know, if you're challenging conservatorship authority, you know, courts just don't have the power to enjoin that. And the court kind of looked at that and they said, what you're doing is you're challenging the conservatorship authority. And so that anti-injunction provision bars that. And so those statutory claims don't go anywhere.
Not because they're wrong in the merits, just on remedial grounds, you can't
get an injunction. We're not even going to get to those. There's nothing a court can do about it. So that's gone. So now we're just left with the one everybody cares about, the constitutional question.
Okay. So how should we think about, and the constitutional question, again, the merits seem pretty straightforward. You know, you can come up with some ways to distinguish this previous case, sale of law. You could decide that the previous case, sale of law, was wrong, as of course some of the justices think it is wrong. But by itself, you know, this might have just been one of those times the court like remands, just gives like a GVR and says, look, we already decided this, you sort it out. So they don't do that. They instead.
Yeah. Although the Fifth Circuit below did agree with, you know, that this was a constitutional problem.
I see. Right. Okay.
So, it is a part of what makes it confusing as to what's going on here is the Fifth Circuit overturned district court's grant of a motion to dismiss and sort of said, you can go back down and deal with your statutory claims. And that was the source of the government's petition for cert. So the government was like, you know, they let these statutory claims go forward. Please, please, you know, overturn that. And then, but then also, this is the en banc Fifth Circuit, agreed that there was a constitutional violation here.
There was a constitutional violation, but that the remedy for the constitutional violation, according to the Fifth Circuit, was not to throw everything out, right? Okay.
And that's part of – that's actually, you know, what the remedy is going to be, I think, is ultimately going to be the more interesting thing to talk about. Because, you know, you said it's pretty straightforward. You think it's dictated by CELA law. And, yes, you can make arguments, and the amicus did make decent arguments. But ultimately, the court rejects those. And not just the court, Justice Kagan herself, who's you know, gotten to be pretty pro stare decisis, also says in her opinion, concurring in part and in the judgment, she says, yeah, you know, I think this is indistinguishable. I don't like CELA law, but on stare decisis grounds, we should follow it. And that leads to the same outcome here on the merits of the constitutional question.
Yes. Although, okay. So Justice Kagan, it's interesting because she says, I agree, this is controlled by CELA law, but I'm still not going to join the majority opinion because one, it contains a bunch of this political theory crap about the executive power that I don't believe and is unnecessary. And second, CELA law said it was limited to cases where the agency wielded significant executive power, and the majority opinion here doesn't contain that limitation. She agrees that limitation is satisfied here, so it doesn't matter. Yeah. But suddenly the opinion is being rewritten in a broader way, and her commitment to stare decisis apparently does not include letting Justice Alito creatively reinterpret Chief Justice Roberts' decisions.
Yes. And so, yeah, I mean, I guess we should probably give people the breakdown here, which we haven't done. So we have the majority opinion by Justice Alito and the other conservative justices, except for Justice Gorsuch, join it in full. And then Kagan and Breyer join part of it. And then Justice Gorsuch doesn't join the whole. He joins parts of it, but not other parts. Justice Gorsuch ends up writing separately. Justice Kagan ends up writing separately. Justice Sotomayor ends up writing separately. So it's a bit fractured, but we do at least have a majority opinion.
Yes. Okay. We have a majority opinion for the whole thing, and then various people who are dissenting from various parts. Okay. Okay. So we got too much going on here. We've already tied ourselves in knots. Let me just say, so the part of this that I think is really interesting is the question, when there is an unconstitutional statutory provision, what happens? Right. So suppose we accept that the removal restriction on the director of FIFA is unconstitutional. So what? Right. Does that mean the things the director did were unconstitutional? Does that mean that, you know, we have to set aside his enforcement actions? Does that mean we have to set aside the Third Amendment? And I think everybody on the court, other than Justice Gorsuch, agrees the answer is no, we don't have to necessarily do all those things.
Which is what the plaintiffs wanted. The plaintiffs were like, basically, it's all void. Just, you know, reset the clock. And the court is basically like, no, that's not going to happen.
Right. So what does the court say we should do instead?
Well, so one thing the court could have done was just say, look, we've looked at this. It's unconstitutional, this removal provision, but we've looked at the merits of it. So we've looked at how things went, and we think it didn't make a difference. Therefore, no remedy. It was harmless error.
Yeah.
The court doesn't quite do that. The court instead says, well, we don't think this makes everything void. Maybe you could still get some relief if there's some showing that this really made some big difference, but kind of like prejudges it, I think, and sort of suggests that, you know, probably not, but like Fifth Circuit, why don't you think about that? Quite interestingly, Justice Thomas has a separate opinion that I think we're going to want to linger on for a bit, where he basically is like, yeah, there's definitely not a remedy here. No way. But then Justice Gorsuch goes very much in the other direction. So we have another one of these cases. We've seen a bunch of these over the, you know, recent years since Justice Gorsuch joined the court, where sometimes they're really, you know, kind of hand in hand, and sometimes they actually have very, very different views. Right. So Justice Gorsuch wants a big remedy. He's like, this is all void, right?
Right. So part of what's amazing is, so it's not just that. So until recently, Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch were jointly sort of authoring their own shared theory of sort of alternative severability. the court severability doctrine doesn't make sense for reasons we talked about last week. We were breaking down Arthrex, and because all courts can do is, you know, ignore as void things that are not constitutional. And that should sort of like cut through a lot of this stuff. I mean, judges don't have to do these kind of like complicated remedial decisions, et cetera. And then what's interesting is now in this case, the two of them who supposedly have the same theory are now on opposite sort of poles of the court about the implications of that theory. And in a way, I think it's really interesting, really important. So Justice Thomas's view is, as I understand it, it's the following. Look, the removal restriction is unconstitutional. So, you know, the president can fire the director of FIFA at will. That's, you know, what the Constitution requires.
By the way, we should note that within probably an hour and a half of this opinion coming down, President Biden did fire the director of FIFA. He was like, okay, thanks. You're fired.
That's funny. That's funny. So maybe it makes more of a
basically like this, that the president could, and interestingly, his view is like the president always could, right? This provision of the law was just like always...
Right. So that's the next step. Justice Thomas says, look, that didn't become true just because we issued this opinion. We issued this opinion because that was always true, right? Because that the, you know, especially under the orthodox, the Thomas Gorsuch view of the world, courts don't change the meaning of the Constitution. So the Constitution's always said that. And indeed, in this case, the president has always thought that was true, right? The president was maintaining all along that he could fire the FIFA director at will because the removal restriction was unconstitutional. And I believe even the FIFA director actually agreed, although I'm not positive about that. So in a way, like, there's no, you know, versus Thomas's point of view, like, there is no removal restriction. Like, there was a piece of paper passed by Congress that said there was a removal restriction, but it was never there. You know, so in a way, I mean, that's the part that
you might think. And there wasn't a situation where the president said, you're fired, and then the director went to court and got an injunction being like, I still get to stay here and do all this crazy stuff. Like, that would be different, right?
Exactly. So, and this is important. So for just Thomas's point of view, in a way, like, the problem was self-correcting, at least in this case. There was an unconstitutional removal restriction that never, in fact, restricted any attempted removal. So, you know, our work here is done. And I should note, this is related. And
just one gloss on that. And so what that means is there was no unconstitutional action. Right. There's nothing that the director did that was unconstitutional.
Right. It would be different if the director had done something. The president had said, stop or you're fired. And the director said, can't fire me. And then continue to do a bunch of stuff. Right. And especially if the president had then said, no, you know, you're fired. You're locked out of the building. And the director had gotten an injunction to stay in office. Then it would make a difference. Or so, you know, the original removal cases like Myers and Humphrey's executor are suits about money and back pay. So it'd be different if the director of FIFA had just like been removed and then tried to get back pay saying like I was unlawfully removed like Humphrey's executor did. But none of that happened here. So the removal restriction, you know, if there's a removal restriction in the forest and it doesn't restrict any removals, is it still even a thing? I think Justice Thomas's view has a lot going for it. But Justice Gorsuch doesn't buy this at all, right?
Yeah, so, he goes as far in the other direction, I think, as one could possibly go.
I agree. This is like when Scalia and Thomas split the court in Hamdi or something. It's just like two formalist titans, you know, at opposite ends of the universe, like throwing lightning bolts.
I'm not quite ready to elevate Justice Gorsuch to titan status, like the father of the gods. Come on.
Giant? The giants are below the titans.
I'm not ready to go there yet.
Cyclops?
Good classical reference. You can call him whatever you want. I'm just, you know, if I'm silent about such appellations, don't assume that I agree with them.
They never do, Dan. Okay. So Justice Gorsuch says, look, like the director is in a sense, he's unlawful, right? Here he is. His office is unlawfully structured, unlawfully created, unlawfully insulated from the president. So everything he does is void ab initio.
Yeah. He was without constitutional authority when he took the challenged actions.
Yeah.
These were sort of ultra vires.
Yeah. So I guess I'll start here. I mean, maybe you don't like these kinds of analysis at all, but is this like a duck rabbit problem? Like when Justice Thomas says, look, nothing, you know, nothing unconstitutional happened, no harm, no foul. That makes sense. When Justice Gorsuch says like he's ultra vires, I don't know if you look at it a different way. Does that make sense?
I mean, I think that, you know, it has that feature in the sense that you can see it two different ways. I do think Justice Thomas is right here, though, in the sense that you can draw a distinction between this, and this is something that Justice Thomas says, is like, this isn't a situation where the person was like put into office unconstitutionally, right? Let's say like an appointments clause violation where the person was like appointed by the wrong person.
So why are those different though? Why, I mean, appointments doctrine, removal doctrine, like why should we have this sharp distinction between them?
Well, I think the difference being that the director was like appointed just fine. So the person was in the office fine. So it's, we can't just say everything about that what the person was doing was unconstitutional. And if there was a problem, it's with this restriction on removal on the back end. And if it turns out that that didn't actually, if it didn't have any real world consequences, it's not obvious to me, you know, what if it were shown that the director was appointed and the day the director was appointed, the president and the secretary of commerce and the secretary of treasury and, you know, everybody who's politically accountable said, look, this is exactly what you want to do. We want you to do. Go do it. Right. The fact that there just happens to be this removal restriction that maybe people aren't even paying attention to, that suddenly just renders everything
good. So why wouldn't we ask the same question about appointments? So suppose there was an appointments problem, right? Suppose somebody was appointed by whatever, the president without Senate confirmation, they should have had Senate confirmation, or the direct, you know, the wrong person or whatever. We don't ask, like, did it make a difference? We don't ask, do we think this person's nomination would have gotten held up in the Senate or something? We just say, like, if you're not lawfully appointed, no further questions.
Yeah, although the counterfactual there is a lot harder, I think.
Well, this counterfactual is hard too, right? Like, what would you do if you knew you were more politically accountable? We don't know.
That is true. But I mean, isn't there a difference between saying like, this is the kind of person, these are the circumstances under which anyone can even be in this office versus like, these are the things that you're allowed to kind of like make the office, you know, the kind of specific things you're, you know, I'm trying to think of a more general phrase. Like this is the way the office is supposed to work.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think there is this ultimate, this sharp distinction, Justice Thomas is right, between sort of, do you have the authority? Do you have the lawful authority to be a government mm-hmm. official? And then sort of, did everybody comply with their various duties? Those are different. There's an amicus brief in the case from Professor John Harrison at Virginia that harps on this distinction in a very formalistic way that Justice Thomas cites. I think it's very insightful. If you want to go this route, you can find these distinctions in Hofeld, who's an old jurisprudence scholar from 100 years ago. But I think there is a difference in those two things. But a couple things. One, Justice Thomas appears to have missed this distinction last term in Salem Law, because a lot of the same problems were present there too. And I'm glad he figured it out now. But Justice Gorsuch does sort of hold his feet to the fire on that.
Yeah, and if you have it in your head, do you mind just reminding me of exactly how the remedy works in Salem Law?
I believe in Salem Law, the
majority— It was like an enforcement action, right?
Yeah, it's an enforcement action, and the majority concludes that the four-cause removal provision is unconstitutional, but it doesn't require us to set aside the enforcement action. And Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch say it does, that the director has done something unlawful, and therefore we have to set aside the enforcement action.
Yeah. So what's the difference?
There isn't. Justice Thomas says, oh, it wasn't really raised there, you know.
Yeah.
But the truth is he just hadn't thought of it yet. And now he did, which is great. It's great that he was willing to admit it. So here's the other good example. I don't think Justice Gorsuch uses this one, but you know, it sometimes happens there are these judges who don't have these so-called judges who don't have Article III tenure, like the territorial judges,
mm-hmm.
I think, who are appointed by the president, could even be confirmed by the Senate, but they don't have life tenure. And when one of them is accidentally allowed to sit on a case, it's, you know, automatic reversal. Like you can't.
This is the Nguyen case, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Because you let a judge with an unconstitutional removal situation set in a case, and Justice Thomas says that's a per se reversal.
And you're saying that should be the same as this?
A little bit, right? Shouldn't we ask, well, is there any evidence that the judge in this case, like their unconstitutional lack of life tenure, made a difference? Is there any evidence there was any political pressure on them to decide the case differently? You know, but we don't ask those questions. We just say, like, if you don't have life tenure, you know, you can't.
I guess it feels different to me because you're basically saying, like, you know, you have to have Article III judges decide your case.
Yeah.
This person is not an Article III judge.
Yeah.
Right?
Could that's we in different. A way say the stiff director.
The thing that makes him not an Article III judge is the removal part, is the lack of life tenure. But it just basically means like this person isn't an Article III judge. Whereas like, you know, this director is the director, right? You know.
Well, so if not having life tenure is all it takes to make you not an Article III judge, then why isn't not being removable by the president all it takes to make you not an Article II official?
I think here's the difference, right? Thinking back to Justice Thomas, he just says, look, we just have to look at this as if this removal restriction just doesn't exist, right? Basically, the removal restriction is unconstitutional, so therefore, like,
yeah,
this person is removable at will. But we don't think about, you know, like we don't say like the remedy in that case, the territorial judge case, is like now the territorial judge has life tenure, right?
It's not clear why, right? So in both cases, you have two things. You have like the judge is exercising a certain kind of power and then with a certain kind of tenure. And the two things can't go together. You can't sit on federal cases and not have life tenure. You can't use substantial executive power and not be removed by the president. And in one case, we decide, well, we'll let them keep the enforcement authority and change their tenure. And the other case, we say, well, we'll keep their tenure where it is and change their enforcement authority.
You don't really think those are the same, do you? You're just being a very good devil's advocate. Because it clearly feels different, right? It clearly seems like it would be ridiculous to just say, you know, in that case, well, you accidentally sat in an Article III panel. Now you're an Article III judge.
Yeah, I do think they're different. I do think if you go back and look at the commission that we give to the territorial judges in Guam, it doesn't purport to give them the judicial power of the United States.
Yeah.
Whereas we purported to give the director of FIFA the executive power of the United States.
Yeah, I guess that's different. So if we had all the Article III judges, but had there was a statute that says, and by the way, the president can fire you if he doesn't like your decisions.
Yeah.
I think that the appropriate solution there would be just to say not a thing. You can't do that.
Yeah. I think that's right. But then I think this is all right, but I do think this is where we get back to the merits a little bit. The court's own separation of powers doctrine does not always sharply sort these different doctrines into different boxes. Like we just saw in Arthrex, the court was like, are they unconstitutionally appointed? Or are they constitutionally appointed, but then exercising the wrong kind of power? Who cares?
Yeah.
Maybe it matters. We all care a lot.
That's the, just for people who've already lost track of it, that's the administrative patent judge
case. Yes, right? Exactly.
They were not appointed consistent with, you know, with the appointments clause, as the court found.
Yeah. So I think this works. This sharp distinction works, but it might require us to be a little more careful in how we think through the separation of powers doctrines on the merits in the first place. Like then a lot of stakes are going to be there, whether it's is it a power problem or is it a different problem, which would be fine. I'd love it if the court was more careful about that stuff, but
you want them to be super careful about everything and parsing all these distinctions and, you know, that's fine.
The distinctions that matter. I mean, this is what people hate law professors, I guess. It's like, there are a lot of distinctions that seem like they don't matter. And then later on, it turns out they mattered. So you have to be careful when you gloss them over.
Yeah, okay. I'm just giving you a hard time because I think that's my value add on the show.
Somebody's got to do it. So do you understand the court to take a position on the Thomas versus Gorsuch fight?
Or not exactly. Yeah. I mean, well, they certainly take a position on the remedy, right? I mean, they're more with Thomas on the remedy than with Gorsuch, for sure.
Right. They seem to be close to Thomas, but not quite.
No. I don't think the court endorses this view that this is a nothing because it's basically we just act as if this provision never existed.
Right. Although I take it – so here's – I read them to be very close to Justice Thomas because I read them to say something like, well, we should act like this provision never existed, but I guess we still do have to ask – did people actually ask if they act like the provision never existed? So they say, although an unconstitutional provision is never really part of the body of governing law because the Constitution automatically displaces it, it's still possible for an unconstitutional provision to inflict compensable harm. And that possibility cannot be ruled out. And they give two hypothetical examples, right, which we sort of already talked about. Suppose the president had tried to remove a director, but a lower court had stopped him, right? Then we would say, even though there is no removal restriction, it still caused harm by misleading the lower court into enforcing it when it shouldn't have. Or suppose that the president had made a public statement expressing displeasure with actions taken by the director and had asserted that he would remove the director if the statute did not stand in the way. Then the statute is causing harm through the president's mistaken decision to comply with the statute. So they're sort of remanding to find out, you know, did the statute accidentally do some work that it shouldn't have done, in which case we need to unwind it.
Yeah. And I strongly suspect the answer to that will be no, you know, but as I think Justice Thomas does too. I mean, one reason being that the Secretary of Treasury, you know, was very involved in all this at various points, and the Secretary of the Treasury is directly accountable to the president. And, you know, I don't think there's evidence that the Secretary of the Treasury was like wanting to overrule the director and not being able to and so forth.
Yeah. Great. So that brings me to one more annoying question, which is then should there really have been standing here? Like, isn't it too soon to say there's any standing here if we don't yet have any evidence that this constitutional violation caused any harm?
Yeah. So this is now connecting us with the other kind of big separation of powers type, you know, big common law case we've had so far, California versus Texas, the Affordable Care Act case, right?
Yes.
Which there you're challenging a penalty that is $0 that doesn't do anything. And does that give you standing to try to strike down the whole Affordable Care Act?
Right.
Answer no. And so here you're challenging a removal restriction that I guess we don't think did anything. I guess the difference is we don't know at the outset. Like we can just say at the outset, the removal restriction was pointless. I mean, sorry, we can say that the $0 penalty, like it makes no difference, right?
Sure. Well, I guess we can. Sure. Let's say we could do that.
Whereas under the majority here, there is a theoretical possibility that there could be some injury, right?
Right. Although normally for standing, we require you to show that there is an injury. Before we don't, standing can't be speculative injury.
Yeah. Although, I mean, if the merits have to, like, we don't really, because you could sue someone saying like, you know, you caused me harm, and then figuring out whether the person actually caused the harm is a merits question.
Right? All right. So here's my case for the analogy. So in this case, it seems to me the plaintiffs are kind of doing the bank shot severability thing. They say the removal restriction is unconstitutional, and ultimately that unconstitutional removal restriction, even though it didn't actually come into play directly, is linked to the separate decisions to enforce things against us.
Gives us everything we want, right? That is right. our hook, right, to get this big win.
And then you might respond to them, no, you can't show adequate traceability. You can't show that the removal restriction is traceable to the conduct that happened to you. And the majority here says, for purposes of traceability, the relevant inquiry is whether the plaintiff's injury can be traced to the conduct of the defendant, not to the provision of law that is challenged.
Yeah.
I think if I took that at face value, I would go back to California versus Texas and say, maybe that helps the state. They don't have to show that their injury is traceable to the individual mandate. They just show that like their injuries are traceable to the conduct of the United States.
Yeah, although I guess it's a little different. Where here we're talking about like a person, right? Who there may be some problem with like exactly the way that person is, you know, sitting in office or exercising power.
Yeah.
Whereas in the other situation, there's not like, we're not saying the like Secretary of Health and Human Services is, you know, improperly in office. We're just sort of saying like, they're sort of saying like, I don't like the statute. And there's this part of it that seems bad. Yeah.
That's true. No, here there is at least a possibility that there was like a real world connection. I mean, I think it's not true, but there's a possibility that like the removal actually caused something to happen in the world. The removal restriction caused something to happen in the world that injured the defendants. Whereas in California versus Texas, it was all kind of on paper. It's all about like the paper connections to these things. But I'll say I leave these three opinions, this case, Arthrex, and California versus Texas, not convinced the court has fully worked out how to deal with standing and severability when they interact in these in these complicated cases.
Well, it's because they're waiting for your article.
Well, they're going to have to wait a little bit longer, having given me
they keep trying to slow you down. But you know, one interesting thing in terms of the analogy between this and California versus Texas is that in both of those, Justice Gorsuch bit and was like, okay, I would give you everything you want, right?
Yeah.
I'd go big, which is interesting. It's aggressive.
I do wonder now if we sit down, if a lot of these things will make more sense in the opinions reviewed together. Like, are some of the things Justice Alito cared about in his dissent in California versus Texas influenced by the majority opinion he knew he was writing in Collins? Is Gorsuch's eagerness to go all the way in California versus Texas influenced by how worked up he got in Collins, or vice versa? The Arthrex opinion.
In Arthrex, there's also a split between Gorsuch and Thomas. So
yes,
a lot of disagreement. And so in Arthrex, he also wanted to go big, right?
Yes. And Justice Thomas also wanted to go, had the same comment. I mean, he dissented on the merits more specifically, but he had the same kind of self-correcting point in dissent where he said, if you take the majority's constitutional analysis seriously, the problem sort of cured itself for the same reason. So I think Justice Thomas has gone full John Harrison, which is a good thing. And Justice Gorsuch is clearly trying to chart his own version of this theory. So it's exciting to see, you know, where that's
going. And his version of the theory is whenever you like spot one constitutional issue, like you just void everything, right?
I think it's not just any of the issue. So I think, to be charitable, Justice Gorsuch, I think the idea is there's some set of constitutional issues that are sort of like fundamental or central to the officer's authority. And when they are, you know, those are the issues that cause everything to blow up. Sort of the equivalent of structural error in criminal cases. And, you know, if you aren't quite as formal about it as we were, you could see removal restrictions as being formal. Like if you're a serious unitary executive guy, it's like a really important doctrine.
We have to fit the ACA stuff into that framework though too.
Yeah, I have to, fair enough. I have to work that one in too. But you know, still.
Okay, so one more note about this. You already flagged one of my favorite things, which is Justice Kagan being like, you know, like basically like, I will not endorse this like pablum in the majority about how it's so important to have accountability in the executive state and the president and, you know, all this kind of like JV political theory. Uh-huh. So a couple things to note about that. So first of all, if you don't like that, if like me, you don't like that, because the reason I don't like that is because, you know, the folks who have like started to really, you know, study separation of powers really carefully in the academy over the last couple decades have basically come up with the answer that like, you know, the current separation of powers arrangements in the Constitution rest on some very contestable like normative premises about how stuff is going to work, and probably wrong in a lot of ways. Now, you could still say like, look, those are the that doesn't mean you have to go Breyer and just say, let's be super functionalist. You could just be like, look, this is the way the Constitution lays it out, and those are the rules, and we got to follow them. But the thing I don't like is this kind of reflexive, and this is in the Constitution, and James Madison is a god, and everything in it was correct, and it preserves democracy. Because that just might be wrong. It might actually be the case that the Constitution makes some incorrect assumptions about how things are going to work. But if you don't like that, like me, you know something you're really not going to like? Is the en banc majority opinion in the Fifth Circuit. Have you read this?
A while ago.
Okay. Did you read the first paragraph? This is by the formerly tweeting Texas Supreme Court Justice, now non-tweeting Fifth Circuit Judge, Judge Willett. And his opinion opens this. Thus, the bicentennial of the United States Constitution in 1987 celebrated our founding generation's ingenious system of separated powers, legislative, executive, and judicial. The Constitution inaugurated a revolutionary design, Madisonian architecture infused with Newtonian genius, three separate branches locked in synchronous orbit by competing interests. Goes on, our Constitution's most essential attribute, the separation of powers, presumes conflict, which counterintuitively produces equilibrium as the branches behave not as willing partners, but as wary rivals. And it just goes on and on like this, mixing metaphors and so forth. And I just find that really annoying because like it's wrong in the sense that like the founders are not geniuses. There were things they got wrong, and it, like you can say, like those are the rules they laid out, and I'm a formalist, so I have to follow them. That's fine. Don't like make me swallow this stuff about how like it's so divine, right?
Yeah. So look, I actually agree with most of that, and I'm including the, you know, question of whether the separation of powers is even a good thing. But I do think there is something consequential here, which is even just like how to understand this doctrine, this area of law. Like, so, because you could think the separation of powers rules are really just mechanical rules, like Article 1, Section 7 has this very detailed process for how a bill becomes a law. And it's just like got some, you know, you wait 10 days and the president repasses and a 2/3 vote. Or you could think that it's more of a principle where it's like, you know, there is some sort of principle of executive control that's not exactly written down in one rule, but that the court has to instantiate through a bunch of different doctrines. And the court's removal cases sort of vacillate about which one of those they are. Like, is it that just definitionally the power to fire people is part of the executive power, so just enforcing a rule that's in the Constitution and doesn't matter what its purpose is? Or is the removal power actually a structural inference about how the thing is supposed to work, in which case they kind of need to lean a little bit on the political theory. They could say it's not our political theory, it's Madison's.
Yeah, you could just say, like, this is what they were trying to do, and, you know, maybe that's wrong. But I think the two things don't have to travel together. You could say, like, you know, I think what they were doing was kind of stupid, but I think those are the rules that they laid out. I'm going to follow them. Or you could say, I think what they were doing is great, but I think it's also, you know, the Constitution is pretty flexible. And so if Congress wants to do something different, it can. I mean, or you can link them up.
Yeah, I guess, it's, you know, what I would say is something that's more like, so this is what they're trying to do. I'm not at all sure it was a good idea. It might well be stupid, but I'm not sure that it's stupid. And I think to understand what the rule is, we really do have to kind of understand the logic of it in a pretty sympathetic way. So I'm going to give you a sympathetic account of what they're trying to do, acknowledging that the whole thing might be a mistake. And it wouldn't be quite as rah-rah as Fifth Circuit, but it wouldn't be quite as denatured as Justice Kagan would
want. Yeah, I can live with that. And I honestly, you know, as far as these things go, I didn't think that the majority here was all that bad compared to some of the stuff I read. In other Supreme Court opinions, and certainly in some of these lower court opinions. One other thing on that that's interesting is Justice Kagan sort of talks about the remedy here, and so she sort of kind of tries to paint the remedy probably correctly as something that's going to the constitutional holding not matter that much. Like, it's not going to require undoing huge numbers of decisions of the Social Security Administration, which I guess is also headed by a single removable at, you know, not removable only for cause director. But she sort of says, look, you know, most of those decisions just like aren't ones that the president is paying attention to. So you're not going to be able to show there's any harm in those cases. So we're not going to suddenly have to like overturn all the Social Security Administration decisions. This is on page 5 of her separate opinion. But then she cites, she does a little self-cite where she cites not a previous opinion. She cites her famous and widely cited Harvard Law Review article, Presidential Administration, for the proposition that there's lots of stuff that, you know, the executive branch does that presidents just pay no attention to.
Yeah, no, I like that. I thought that was a nice little move.
Some judges don't like the self-cite to their kind of academic work, and some do.
I think this is a special case, though, where the Kagan article on presidential administration gets cited a lot by advocates, and I think including by sort of advocates on the other side who are pushing strong presidential control.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not at all – it seems especially fair.
It's not gratuitous. It's a very important article. It's I think it's of her academic work. It's, you know, her most successful, widely cited, important article.
Right. Exactly. I mean, I'm not saying she would have cited it if it were by somebody else, but it's not gratuitous and it's already sort of part of the conversation. So it's makes sense to me.
She would have cited it if you wrote it, Will, I promise.
Justice Kagan has never cited me.
Yet. Maybe she'll cite this episode. We'll see. That'd be not great. Yeah, that's the question. Which justice is most likely to cite one of our episodes? And I did the math, and they're all 0% likely to cite our episodes, unfortunately. So I think we need to wait for you to get up there, Will. And then you can do a self-cite.
We should stop the podcast.
Too late, yeah. Okay, so there's a ton in that case. Actually, I could probably go on talking about that one for a while. It involves con law and money, two things that I like, but we should probably talk about another case that I guess I should be more excited about because I teach criminal procedure. This is Lang versus California, Fourth Amendment case. But I'm finding it a little hard to get as worked up about this case.
Yeah, I hear you. So this is a case about the so-called hot pursuit exception to the so-called warrant requirement. Is that right?
Yes. Okay. Lots of so-calleds in that sentence. But yes, the Fourth Amendment prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures and also lays out requirements for warrants. The court has for quite some time said, one thing that makes a search unreasonable is the lack of a warrant. But then there are certain circumstances where we're going to say there is no need to have a warrant. And generally, one of those is exigent circumstances. So some reason why, like, it's things you got to move quickly and you can't go get a warrant. And in talking about that, the court has tended to say, that there's emergencies, need to prevent destruction of evidence. And then one of the things they've kind of listed is a hot pursuit, most typically hot pursuit of a fleeing felon is the kind of classic example. But this case is about, hot pursuit of a person who is suspected of a misdemeanor.
A fleeing misdemeanant.
Yes. Noun. Okay. The noun form of the offender.
Yeah. And so and what's really at stake here, right? So I guess the majority says sometimes yes, sometimes no. Right?
Yeah. So
categorical.
Let's put it differently. The majority rejects the proposition that the fact that the police are pursuing, chasing someone who is suspected of committing a misdemeanor, they reject the proposition that always lets you follow the person into a house without a warrant. So they reject the categorical rule. They do not adopt a categorical rule in the other direction by any means, saying that you never get to do that.
Okay. And on that point, I think they have seven justices, right? It's 7-2 with Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito in dissent on that point.
Yes.
Okay. So Roberts and Alito say we would have a categorical rule, and Kagan says it's not a categorical rule. There's an interesting side concurrence from Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Thomas about a couple other things, but on that question, is this just rules versus standards? It's just like, should we have a categorical rule or should we have a standard? And don't we have this fight in the Fourth Amendment all the time, and sometimes we want a rule and sometimes we want a standard, and nobody's consistent about which one they want. I don't know.
It's kind of like, what do you think of as the relevant rule? Because this gets a little confusing, is that one way to understand the rule is no warrant needed for exigent circumstances. What are exigent circumstances? You're chasing someone suspected of a crime, hot pursuit. But then the court seems to say you get to do, like, hot pursuit isn't its own necessarily really its own exception, right? Hot pursuit is a thing that provides one of the other bases for exigent circumstances. This is sort of on page 10. The court says, we have no doubt that in a great many cases, flight creates a need for police to act swiftly. A suspect may flee, for example, because he is intent on discarding evidence, or his flight may show a willingness to flee yet again while the police await a warrant. So sort of like basically, the rule is you always get to go without a warrant if you're trying to prevent flight from this location or prevent destruction of evidence. But the flight, the mere single act of flight itself does not provide the justification.
Yeah. Okay. So this is where I end up sympathetic to Justice Kavanaugh, who says, I add this brief concurrence simply to underscore that in my view, there is almost no daylight in practice between the court's opinion and the Chief Justice's opinion.
Yeah. And I think that's true. And I also think that it's also going to be true in a couple of ways. And also, like, the majority's opinion also is not going to matter to basically anyone. This is why I'm having trouble getting worked up about it. So with respect to the first point, how many cases are there going to be where a police officer is in hot pursuit of a misdemeanant, but we know there's no reason to think the person might flee again, or they might just destroy evidence or something like that. I mean, sure, sometimes, but a lot of times things are going to be sufficiently uncertain,
yeah,
that you can probably point to one of these other interests.
Yeah. Now, I will say the Jeff Fisher, I think it was, raised an oral argument. The scenario was the most plausible would be minors or kids. That'd be the most plausible, that like the police are breaking up a party or whatever, and somebody goes fleeing back to their parents' house. And under the circumstances, it's both like, you can see why it's understandable why the kid is doing that, but unlikely they're going to become like a fugitive from justice or destroy evidence.
Have you ever fled a house party that was broken up by the police?
So, okay. So true story. When I was in high school, a bunch of my classmates decided to TP our government teacher's house. And I refused to take part in this because it was a violation of private property rights. And I found that morally objectionable. But I didn't want them to think I was as much of a spoil sport as I was. So I agreed to kind of follow them along, but not take place, take part in the TPing. So I actually was like driving behind them, sort of, I don't know, out of solidarity or something. But then I wasn't carrying any TP. At which point our government teacher, it turns out, had been tipped off about this whole thing. Not by me, I swear, but one of my classmates.
This was like one of the other students. This is like the, I don't know, the 1990s equivalent of like showing the Snapchat to your mom or something.
Apparently. Yeah. So as everybody arrives at his house, four police cars then like turn their lights on and roll out of all the neighboring driveways. And police officers start like grabbing kids and throwing them in the back of the cars. It was actually a police officer who would like come to class to do the like, I'm a police officer, let's talk about, you know, how that works thing. They ended up like, I guess, you know, seizing a huge number of my classmates, ultimately letting them go without even like any sort of formal arrest. It was just sort of a don't do that slash a show by the government teacher that he punked us. But as soon as the police cars started rolling out, I just drove off. And then I spent the next couple hours circling the neighborhood, picking up people who were fleeing the police and ferrying them.
Oh, so you were an accessory after the fact. We're outside the statute of limitations, so it's fine.
I think so.
I'm pretty sure.
So I was not myself fleeing the police because I had not done anything wrong.
You were aiding and abetting.
Well, I mean, I was just giving people a ride.
No, but you were look, I teach criminal law. You're an accessory after the fact. You were helping them evade detection with knowing that they had committed a crime with the intent to do so, right? Like all the elements.
I don't think I had the intent.
Why were you picking them up? Why were you driving? Why didn't you just go home?
I wanted to hang out with them. Okay. I was there to hang out in the first place.
Your best defense, I don't know. Hope you had a good lawyer. I didn't think I was going to get that good of a story. That's pretty good. I have fled one house party broken up by the police. I didn't really have to flee. They just came in and there were a lot of people there and I walked out and nobody hassled me because they were bigger fish to fry, I think. It was a party with a bunch of D1 football players, of which I was not one. So I walked out.
I've never got invited to that kind of party.
I wasn't really invited. It was just, I think we kind of crashed it, but it wasn't.
I didn't even know about the parties.
Yeah. Well, the thing I wanted to know is in your story, how many people accused you of being the rat? Why you were picking people up. You were trying to show that you were not the rat,
I will say, I admit from the external point of view, it looks really suspicious that this like one guy is just like there refusing to participate, but like hanging out for no obvious reason. And then suddenly gets out of the way when the police spring the trap. I admit.
But although the smarter thing to do would have been to feign, to be what we call in criminal law, the feigned accomplice, where you pretend to go along and then have the police take you away and then sort of secretly, you know, whisk you off to safety. But if any of your high school friends are listening, he didn't do it. It was not him.
I just believed in private property and wanted to hang out. Is that too much?
And you still do. You really haven't changed. So you didn't go through like a communist period at some point?
When I was in eighth grade, I was an anarchist.
I assume that was a reaction to some kind of parental discipline or school policy.
I just couldn't figure out any reason that government power was justified.
But you, by high school, you had... Somehow, like the summer after eighth grade, you figured that out.
By high school, I became a libertarian because my socialist government teacher accused me of being a libertarian. And I'd never heard of that. And so I went and looked it up. And that was sort of my gateway to like libertarian literature. And I was like, oh, yeah, that sounds pretty good.
And when did you start blogging in this process?
In college.
Okay. That's college later. Development.
Yeah. No, in law school, in high school, we had early access to Lexis at home because my dad used it. And so I set up a bunch of like Lexis keyword alerts for like various libertarian figures. And so I would read like random news clippings about like libertarianism.
Were you like an Ayn Rand devotee in high school?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. I saw that coming. Did you wear a suit to school every day?
What? No.
Did you wear a suit?
I wore sweatpants.
Okay. Every day. And there was a type I encountered in high school, the type who wore a suit and was into Ayn Rand, but went out of suit.
Sweatpants.
Okay. I'll stop giving you a hard time.
Okay.
But yeah, back to this case. That was quite a tangent, but I think people are going to enjoy it. I did. So some of the time, a lot of the time, you're going to be able to do it anyways. And then what happens if the officer screws up and, you know, enters without a warrant in a case where we don't actually think, you know, there was quite enough of a showing of, you know, that the flight indicated destruction of evidence or, you know, further flight.
Okay. So we're thinking about Justice Thomas here.
Well, there's actually two reasons why it doesn't matter, right? I think one of which is the Justice Thomas reason, but also like in all those cases, isn't that going to be within the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule? Basically, this is the rule that like as long as the police are kind of, you know, close enough and, you know, they're not kind of deliberately violating the Constitution and it's like, sufficiently unclear, no exclusion. And I think that given how fuzzy this test is, I think it's always going to be good faith, right?
Maybe. I think there's still an open question about how broad or narrow the good faith exception is.
Yeah.
You know, but sure. And that gives us to, I think, the most interesting thing to me with this opinion. So Justice Thomas wrote separately, among other things, to remind us that he does not believe in the exclusionary rule, both that it's narrow as a matter of doctrine and that, you know, he doesn't really think we should have it in the first place. And Justice Kavanaugh joins. Justice Kavanaugh had not, I think, previously been on the record with any kind of particular exclusionary rule skepticism. And it's just interesting that Justice Kavanaugh.
Although I think I would take Justice Thomas's opinion as, you know, more being like, for these purposes, basically sort of saying like there should be a categorical exception to the exclusionary rule here. And that's the part Kavanaugh agrees with.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that Kavanaugh is necessarily tipping his hand and saying, I don't believe in the exclusionary rule, right?
Well, the last paragraph of Justice Thomas's opinion is, aware of the substantial costs created by the exclusionary rule, courts have sometimes narrowed the protections of the Fourth Amendment to avoid having to exclude evidence, citing Akhil Amar, like the most famous academic critic of the exclusionary rule right now. But it should be the judicially created remedy, not the Fourth Amendment, that contracts in the face of that pressure.
Yeah, but you could say the remedy should contract when that pressure, but not that the remedy should never exist.
No, right. You could. It's just the opinion only makes sense if you share the view that the exclusionary rule is kind of suspect. This constant narrowing.
Yeah, or at least something that should be that's broader than it should be. I mean, you know, I mean, a note in Justice Kavanaugh's concurrence, you know, he doesn't say a lot about this, but he says, I join the court's opinion. I also join part two of Justice Thomas's concurrence regarding how the exclusionary rule should apply to hot pursuit cases.
Yeah.
So he seems to, you know, be characterizing his join as about, you know, kind of the application of the exclusionary rule to this one context.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying he's gone full Clarence Thomas or full Akhil Amar here, but it's just otherwise an out of position join that I kind of like.
You like it because you agree with the merits, or you just like it because it shakes things up?
Both. Both. Okay. I do think the exclusionary rule is not the best remedy for these things, although better than nothing. And sometimes I worry we're going towards nothing. And I think
we are going to nothing if we have the court. This, you were going to write a paper about this a long time ago. This was on your original research agenda, right? Like this question of Fourth Amendment remedies.
Yes.
I think this is super interesting, right? Which is, you know, exclusionary rule. Yeah. It's kind of a modern innovation, right? It didn't really exist a couple hundred years ago. It's more of a 20th century. Starts out in the federal government, like in the 20s, right? Mm-hmm. And then gets applied to the states later on. But basically the whole remedial framework for sort of Fourth Amendment violations looked totally different 200 years ago.
Right. Well, we used to have a lot more tort suits and no qualified immunity. And now we've made it harder to get the tort suit and created qualified immunity.
And we also didn't really have even like a professionalized police the way we do now. Like there were the constables and people that were kind of more like deputized citizens. And so the whole, you know, and I think that's the best kind of argument for an exclusionary rule is like this is kind of a translation of the Fourth Amendment to the modern context. You know, you could imagine a different remedial regime, but it does seem like if we were going to get rid of it, you have to really, in order to effectuate the Fourth Amendment, we'd really need to kind of have some other calibration on other parts of the doctrine and other areas of law.
Yeah, part of the pitch for the paper, it might be a book one day, is, you know, we had the 19th century remedial regime, which was heavily sort of tort-based and liability-based. Then we replaced it with the 20th century remedial regime, which was much more heavily exclusionary rule-based. And the 21st century remedial regime appears to be to get rid of the 20th century regime without bringing back the 19th century regime. And that seems like the worst of all worlds.
Yeah.
It's a good case to be made for full originalism. It's a good case to be made for compensating translation, but the sort of the mix and match. So the best line in Justice Thomas's dissent, the last line, criminal defendants must rely on other remedies.
Yeah.
Justice Thomas, please tell us about these other remedies and where you think we can get them. I am interested in them.
Yeah, because I mean, taking a step back, I mean, this case really kind of exemplifies those 21st century problems, right? Because I think realistically, this is not going to result in exclusion almost ever for some combination of the two reasons we talked about, but also it's never going to result in other remedies either. Like you're going to go sue for trespass, like, because that just doesn't happen very often. Are you going to sue for a constitutional tort under Section 1983? I don't know. What are your damages? So, I mean, it's this, we're really building up this fairly complex edifice of Fourth Amendment law. And we're kind of fighting about it, but like for practical purposes right now, who's it helping, right? Who's helped? Who actually benefits from this versus a more categorical rule? Does it make any difference in terms of like how much searching is going to happen? Maybe a little tiny bit.
Yeah.
Not a lot, right?
Maybe an officer training. I mean, so you can sue a municipality if they have a, you know, faulty training programs. Maybe at least it'll change the training programs.
But, yeah, maybe, but they'll also just say, but by the way, you know, there's no exclusion or, you know, there's reason, yeah. As long as it's a close call, probably no exclusion or, yeah. I mean, this okay, is a weird area where like there's, you know, this big conceptual distinction between rights and remedies. And a lot of the, I think some of the conservative justices have been very good on the substance, the rights part of the Fourth Amendment, but then they basically, you know, Justice Scalia, as far as I can tell, like didn't really think there should be much of a remedy. And so yeah. It kind of makes the whole broad proclamations about the importance of the right kind of ring a little hollow.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and this, of course, goes back to, you know, earlier this term, we talked about Ramos, the broad right to jury trial, and then the retroactivity decision that makes that, you know, remedially much less exciting. This is it's a common pattern a bunch of people have written about.
But at least that does help a lot of people going forward.
Sure.
Right. The problem with this is that not only does this not help people retroactively, it's not clear this makes any difference in the future either.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Fair enough.
Okay. So anything else we want to say about this? I mean, this is, you know, just one of these kind of narrow, kind of fact-specific cases. The court disagrees a little bit. It reminded me of, Birchfield. Is that the one?
I have a block on that case. That's one of those drunk driving cases where the court says a bunch of weird stuff.
Yeah, it was about exigent circumstances for, if I'm remembering this right, I was kind of hoping that you were just going to spout off the holding because usually you're able to do that, about, you know, when you can do kind of like a warrantless exigent circumstances breathalyzer and blood draw.
And I think I intentionally didn't read that case.
Oh, okay. I thought you read everything.
I didn't care.
With that one.
I make exceptions, and Birchfield versus North Dakota was one of them.
But anyways, there was disagreement on the court between a categorical rule that basically you can always do the warrantless blood tests versus, you know, a sort of fact specific. Well, you can when there's really exigent circumstances, but it's not really clear how much the two of those things are, how much, you know, distance there is between those two things in practice.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we finally made it through the stack of interesting opinions we got from the court. So that'll have to do us until we get more. Thanks very much for listening. And please remember to rate and review us on iTunes or wherever you listen to the podcast. We are still looking to get people interested in the show, and reviews are a really important part of that.
And please leave us a voicemail, 314-649-3790. Shoot us an email, pod@dividedargument.com. Check out our merchandise at store.dividedargument.com. Heard some from some folks who've already gotten their t-shirts. They're high quality. So check those out. And if you are aware of any exciting parties, please invite Will to them.